David, and I want to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak here and interact with all the participants. My talk today is about supersymmetry and random matrices. My original motivation for going to supersymmetry was I had spent many years trying to understand by perturbative means random Schrodinger operators, and especially the question of extended states, eigenvalue spacings, the average Green's functions, and so forth. And then finally I stumbled upon the fact that many of these questions were similar but much simpler for random matrices and for random band matrices. So, and they are very well adapted to the supersymmetric method, which I will partly describe today. And actually, you heard much of this method you heard from David Bridges when he was describing a self-avoiding walk. I won't assume that you remember what he told you, but let me begin by at least giving a little bit of background here. So the main title of my talk will be Random Matrices and How You Can Map It into Statistical Mechanics. And this statistical mechanical system is a little unusual because it has a non-compact symmetry, a hyperbolic symmetry, as well as a compact symmetry, an SU2 symmetry, which we'll see later. And so the most of the work that I'll talk about today is in collaboration, at least the results that have been proven were proved with Martin Zirnbauer, and it's published in CMP last year. But the idea of the supersymmetric approach to spectral theory, the idea of converting random systems into statistical mechanics goes back to Franz Wegener. He used the replica trick, which is, I think he had some very insightful papers there. But from a mathematical point of view, this was not entirely satisfactory. And then Eketov came along and said, well, I don't need to use replicas. All I have to do is introduce Grassmann variables to cancel determinants. And that was his big contribution. And then more recently, Jan Fyodorov has shown a way to treat, I think, very effectively what I'll call the bosonic sector with collective variables, which I'll explain, rather than doing some ampli continuation. So there's no ampli continuation, and so that's his contribution, I would say. So basically what I'll describe is kind of like an Ising model. Before I get into too many details, let me just explain that I will be eventually studying an interaction that looks at the following type. You have a sum, you have a Jij, and you have Si, Sj. So that looks like your canonical Ising type model, except that I have to have a trace out here. I need e to the minus, this trace. And the S's will come in two types. But the one that I will particularly focus on is the bosonic one. And this Sj will have the form Tj inverse 1, 0, 0, minus 1, Tj, where these Tj's, run over Su 1, 1. I'll come back to this later, but This is a non-compact symmetry group which preserves an indefinite form. And so these spins, although they're square, if you check, the square is 1, right? But they are unbounded. So, and you can see that this, the symmetry group of this guy, if you rotate everything, has this SU11. And actually, to regularize this, I need to add in a small epsilon times a trace of Sj times sigma 3. So So there's a little regularization that I need to put in here. Otherwise, because of the non-compactness of the integral, everything flies away. Okay. So this is like an icing model, except that my spins really belong to the Poincaré disk, and it's non-compact, and I have a symmetry group that sits behind it. This is only a piece of the model that I'll be talking about, but that will be the main piece. So I'll come back to it later, but that's where I'm headed for, trying to understand that model, just to give you an idea of where I'm going. The J's are going to belong to a two-dimensional or two or three-dimensional lattice. So they belong to, let's say I really work in Z3, and you pick some periodic box in here, and we're taking the thermodynamic limit, and I and J belong to that box. This last one here is a regularization term. Let me write it separately. But this, you see, this integral by itself doesn't make sense. So I need to regularize it. Okay. So the regularization. Let me put the regularization on this board below. And I have to add an epsilon. And this will be the same epsilon we're going to see in a few transparencies. I need to add an epsilon times the trace of the sum of the SJs. It's like a magnetic field, except that I have to multiply it by this matrix. And this guy is positive. And it's definite. And so this regularizes your system. Yeah. No, it's not. All you have to think, you have to play around with the fact that this is SU11 and use the relations to see it's definite. Yes, now how do I put the measure? The measure is just a Haar measure. Haar measure induced by here. Okay, so that's what we'll ultimately be analyzing. And now, what I'm going to do is motivate how you get there, okay, and how it arises from random matrices, and how you analyze this kind of expression using convexity. Okay, so convexity is turns out to be an extremely useful tool for analyzing such a thing. And one of the reasons you might imagine that convexity is a useful tool is that, of course, the space in which these things lie don't really have any topology. In other words, the geometry is complicated because of the hyperbolic structure, but the Poincaré disk has no topology. It's contractible. So this, I think, is quite important. And when you do, there's a similar sector. This is what's going to be called the bosonic sigma model sector. There's a completely analogous one in which these guys are replaced by SU2. Okay? And then you have a compact. That's the fermionic sector. That will be a compact thing. That, of course, is well known as a classical Heisenberg model. So what the full model will be some kind of coupling between this hyperbolic sector, and which I described here, roughly speaking, and the fermionic sector in which the spins really take values in the sphere. So now let me try to explain. That's where I'm headed for. Let me back up and explain the motivation and how we get there and how we get to that point. Okay. So let me tell you that the matrices that we look at. So this is a different. I think I can take this off and go to the next transparency. So we will look at the simplest model for us to look at are these n-orbital matrices. So these matrices are a little bit, take a little getting used to. You're indexed, you have two indices. You have the lattice index, which belongs to this box lambda, and I'd like to take it to be a periodic cube, which is going to get very big, and then an orbital index. Now, this orbital index has to be at least 2 for this Fyodorov picture to work well, but we fix it, and it is a useful parameter, so we typically fix it to be large. So that's our small, 1 over n is going to be our small parameter, but n will be fixed. We're not letting it go to infinity. Okay. Now, if you fix So this is the matrix. It has indices I, j, alpha, beta. Okay, And the matrix has the following structure. Basically, all the elements are independent, but the variance, off-diagonal variance, goes to zero. So let me show you a picture of this so you can get some feeling what it looks like. So in one dimension, it has a very simple block structure. Okay. So if you're in one dimension, then you can imagine these n-by-n blocks, tri-diagonal blocks. Okay, and in each block I have basically along the diagonal blocks I have GUE matrices. These are just Gaussian unitary invariant matrices, Hermitian matrices, and so all you're doing is really you're putting in some additional block structure into the problem, and apart from that you can just. I will often forget this index because it will emerge just as a factor in the end. But all it does is really to create blocks for you. Okay. So we take a finite range. The Jij is finite range, and it's the fact that we've chosen this Jij to be, let's say, finite range, which gives it a non-mean field character. So this is very different in one dimension than it is in two dimensions, than it is in three dimensions. All those dimensions will be quite different. You can't, in higher dimensions, you can't write it in this way. You know, you can't index it this way. Okay, it's a sparse matrix, but so the motivation for this is the Jij plays the role of locality. It keeps things local. And we believe that this model behaves very much like random Schrödinger does, except that not only are your diagonal elements random, your off-diagonal elements are random as well. And the fact that these off-diagonal elements are random, these blocks here have random entries, makes things much simpler. The deterministic character of random Schrödinger makes things a lot harder. So that's a little bit of the that's the model that really motivates us. So if I have a single site, let me just say, if I just have one site and my box consists of a single point, then this is just GUE. This is the Gaussian unitary ensemble. So all I've done is to couple them together in these blocks. Okay, but there's no long-range Jij; they're local. Okay, so as I said, I'm not letting n go to infinity, so I'm not. That would be too simple. N is fixed, and I want the volume to go to infinity. So it's a little bit different game than the usual GUE.
And there's nothing random in the J's.
Precisely right. There's nothing random in the J's. They're frozen. Okay. And you want the diagonal one, which is this guy, to be big, and the off-diagonal ones not to be so big, relatively speaking. So that's the formalism. Okay, so let me move on to the next transparency. So there are many conjectures about this model, and let me just state a couple of them. The main conjectures are that if I take the Green's function in three dimensions, And so there it is. That is my Green's function in three dimensions. And I square it. It's very important that I take the modulus and square it. Otherwise, I'm only getting information about the density of states, which we already understand. But this will tell you about the character of the wave function, the Green's function. So if you understand this, and in particular, if you understand that in d equals 3, this is bounded by some constant that's uniform in the volume. So you need the energies not to be too large, because otherwise you'll be in the Lifshitz tail and you'll have localization. You need epsilon to be big enough so that when you multiply epsilon times the volume of the box, you must be bigger than 1. Otherwise, if epsilon gets to be too small, this epsilon, by the way, is the same as this epsilon up to multiples. They're really the same. This is a regularization of this sigma model. This is a regularization of this Green's function. Okay. So what do we learn from, if we can prove this is bounded, what do we learn from this? Well, we learn that the wave function is extended. And what that means is that if I compute this norm here, I just sum over the box and I have an L2 state, that this norm goes down, this average L4 norm, if you like, goes down proportional to the 1 over volume. And that's the best, that means it's uniformly spread out over the sites in the box, all right? So if it were peaked at a single site, it would not go to zero, of course, but because it's sort of uniformly spread over the box, you get something bounded by some time. So this is a conjecture, and it is sort of a very strong form of extended states. So the second major conjecture, which we would like to understand with this formalism, now you can put random Schrödinger, or you can put this system here in, and of course this is the one I think I have a better chance of understanding. So the other big question is the eigenvalue spacings. So the idea is if you're in three dimensions and you choose a box which is sufficiently large, and you look at the eigenvalue spacings, then there's a very natural conjecture from this theory that says that the eigenvalue spacings rescaled appropriately are identical to those of GUE, are identical to those with just one single site. Now, this is not true in one dimension, and it's not true in two dimensions, but it should be true in three dimensions. Three dimensions, there's less fluctuation of the field, and the zero modes dominate is really what happens here. And this is the picture of universality that you get from the supersymmetry, which I haven't really gotten to yet, but that's the idea is when you convert it into statistical mechanics, you get a saddle manifold, and all the action lies on this manifold. Okay, it's a finite dimensional manifold it's actually a symmetric space, and that symmetric space only depends upon the symmetry. But if you see, you have to worry about fluctuations away from the saddle, and that's where the dimension is very important. If you're in one dimension, there's too much fluctuation and the saddle is not dominant. If you're in low dimension, if you're in high dimensions like three or more, then the fluctuations are suppressed, as I will try to explain for this model. The fluctuations are suppressed. And you should imagine that you are, in fact, governed by the zero mode, mainly this whole saddle governs everything. And this is universality. It's not universality, I should emphasize, in the sense of critical phenomena. It is universality of the zero mode, roughly speaking, okay, the geometry of the zero mode. We do not understand, I don't think, I've never heard a physicist, at least not recently, claim they understand the critical phenomena, in other words, the transition between localization and delocalization. That would be critical phenomena. This is not truly critical phenomena. It's universality, but it's not critical phenomena. This is saying that mean field is valid, absolutely. It's all not more than that, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they're all captured by the nonlinear sigma model. But the problem, but you don't know whether the critical point is captured by a sigma model. But we don't know what I don't think you know what the critical exponents are in three dimensions, or even what the upper critical dimension is. Oh, two, yes. That's the lower. But if I wanted to actually compute the three, or what the upper critical dimension is, this is also something quite mysterious, I think. Okay. So let me move on, from the conjectures to a digression. Okay. So let me go to this digression, because actually this is a digression. Even if you have no appreciation for random matrices particularly, there is a problem which is in two dimensions, which is very closely related to it. So let me describe the where this model comes from, and I'll describe the model. This model comes from what I understand from a paper by Cardi and his collaborators, and they are interested in a model of quantum evolution, in a random media, so it really falls into the nature of disordered quantum systems. So he has a unitary rule for updating his quantum evolution. And this is a remarkable accident, perhaps. It's, I would say, at least in part an accident, because the model is equivalent to a kind of random walk in a random environment with memory. Okay, so I'll try to explain this. But this is like what sometimes is called a mirror model. It's not identical to Cohen's mirror model, as I'll say. But it's, so let me just describe the model first of all, and then. But the remarkable thing that Cardi noticed is that for this particular model, you can describe everything in terms purely probabilistically. There's no phases. The phases have all been integrated out, and so it's a problem on what he calls a Manhattan lattice. And it seems to me, very interesting properties. So the model is extremely simple to describe. I take an oriented lattice, namely the Manhattan lattice, with alternating directions for the streets. And we place scatterers. These are my scatterers. They're placed randomly on the grid with some density or some. So let's say P is the probability that it's occupied, and 1 minus P is not occupied, and that's done independently. So I have a bunch of scatterers on the grid, and I want to understand what happens to a path on the grid. So how does the path move? Well, let's see how I have this thing going here. Well, let's say I start here. He moves over here, and this is an up one, so he has to go over here. So he cannot go through the obstruction or the scatter. He's turned at the scatter and just follows the arrows until he hits the next scatter and so forth. This one moves down and so forth. So you don't have to have any mirrors or anything. This is the model that Cardi described and made a number of conjectures about using renormalization group analysis. And I'd like to just say a few words about it, because I think it's a very appealing model, and I'm not sure it's that much simpler than other models that are around, but it's certainly simple to explain. So what is this conjecture? Conjecture is that all paths eventually form closed loops with probability 1. Now, that's actually not a pretty generic statement. That probably happens in many cases. But the real thing is that the average diameter of the loop, in other words, if I looked at the diameter of the entire loop, the average diameter of the loop would be e to the 1 over rho squared. That's the conjecture. So if the density is small, these loops are huge. Not all loops, of course. You can find some short ones, but the average loop length is enormous. Okay. This is very much as it is in the supposed to be in classical Heisenberg. In fact, this model that Cardi discusses really has randomness, which are SU2 matrices, which are random on edges. So this comes out of some more complicated story, but let me just leave it like this. So the conjecture is that this is a localization, of course. This is a network model for some type C superconductor, and so this is his conjecture. I think he also conjectures that if you look at the path for a very long time, if you have scatter, you will see that the path essentially executes random walk. In other words, it really looks like a random walk for a very long time scale, but then eventually closes up. And we love to understand those things. Yes. Yes. If you change this model, everything goes crazy. Okay. So there's a model which I'm sure you know by Cohen, the Cohen's mirror model, and then the conjecture is that all loops are closed, and we know that if it's fully packed. Okay. But if the loops are not fully, but even if when they are fully packed, we know the loops are closed with probability 1, but the average diameter is infinite. It's not finite. Okay, because it's percolation. and the, at TC, and your loops are huge, and there are loops of arbitrary scale. So yes. It's supposed to. I think I have one of the arrows here must be a little bit wrong. Is that what you're noticing? Second from the top, you mean here, or?
No, to the left of that one.
This guy. Oh, yeah, I did something wrong there. I should have turned there. I made a few mistakes. That's not there. Yeah, you can start at a point. This is my, yeah, so this is, let's say this is not there, it's my starting point. Yes, that counts as closed loop. But it's not a scatterer. Forget it's not, let me not let it be a scatterer. I don't start at a scatterer, I start at an edge, and then I see whether I close. Okay? But you can cross yourself, you know, the paths do cross, okay? So this is the model. I guess my picture is needs a little bit of work. And you're quite right. This guy should have turned, right? If it were a scatterer, he should have turned. And I also think that somewhere here, I've got one of the... I think when I sketched this quickly, that I noticed a little while ago that one of the guys is going the wrong way, going the wrong... on the street on the wrong way. Anyhow... But I think the idea should be clear, so these are the conjectures, and what can we prove? What can we prove? Well, it's not what I can prove. I have played with this thing a while. It's very amusing to play with, actually. If the density of scatterers is bigger than a half, then you can prove that all loops are closed. Now, if I do a mirror model, in which case I have something a little bit different. I don't have the orientation, and I have some other thing. Then we don't know such a thing, okay? But you know that all loops are closed, and I'm going to give you a proof. This is basically Chalker's proof. What is the proof? Well, for every such scatterer I have here, I look at the orientation of the lines, and then I draw a kind of mirror, a kind of line that connects the middle of this thing to the midpoint of that square. Just draw a little line. And what that means is, if you see, this guy is supposed to move up here, and then he gets reflected off this. Now you think of this thing as reflecting off this line, he moves to the right, then he gets reflected down here. So if you have edge percolation, and these edges now appear with a chance of larger than 50-50, then you'll have regions, always you'll have regions where these guys are trapped. Okay? So they cannot escape. So simply by appealing to various simple ideas in percolation, you can check that you can block long loops no matter what you do, as long as the probability is high enough. Okay? Because these edges themselves percolate and they block the electron, or whatever you want to call it, from moving. So this is quite different from Cohen's mirror model, I would say, and is very closely connected to true self-avoiding walk. There are various versions of what they call not self-avoiding walk, as David was describing, but true self-avoiding walk. The other comment that I find quite interesting, but I don't fully understand, so if there's somebody here who can shed some light on this, I would find it very interesting. Now, notice that all paths here can never visit, if you think about it, they can visit the same site twice, like this guy's visited the same site twice, but it can never visit the same edge twice. Okay? Edges cannot be revisited, except if it goes around and around, but not by any other loop. It's not
So these are self-avoiding in the sense that they have self-avoid edges. Edges self-avoid. Okay. So you think, well, maybe this is like a self-avoiding wall, except I have edges. But no, there's some attraction here. If you look at the effective weights on these guys, there's a little bit of attraction. And so basically what the theory is that I don't quite understand is that this thing is a polymer, okay, but it's in a collapsed space. Okay. I mean, it sounds very reasonable, but so you think about the theory of polymers. Now, polymers look like, in general, in the dilute form, they spread out, but these guys' claim is that they will not spread out because there's some implicit attraction which makes them form these compact structures. Okay, so that's all I have to say about that. That's, no, this is for all p. All p. Now, it's trivial to see that, of course, this argument is correct for p bigger than a half. You can also convince yourself that p a half is not really the crucial one. If you think about it, you'll see that you can make p a little bit smaller, and then the question is really how much smaller can I make it? But the claim is that no matter how small p is, you will eventually trap. But then the scales get huge, of course. So there's always collapse, is the claim. Okay, now let me get to, so that's an aside, and now let me try to do something quite like what David Bridges was talking about yesterday. So I want to explain to you how you can go from Green's functions to statistical mechanics and maybe get some information that way. So this is the key transparency. All I will be doing from here on is taking averages and doing a little bit more stuff, but it's not much more than this, the main idea. So here we have a Hamiltonian that we want to compute the Green's function for. This is the guy I'm after. This guy at the moment is going to be a nuisance. I have to kill him with fermions, okay, or something. I have to multiply by a determinant to the plus power, so I need Grassmann variables for that. But I'm going to drag these along because I'm mostly going to be talking about the bosonic sector, so I don't have to introduce Grassmann variables. So here we form just the quadratic form x h x, and I just contract the indices. It's just the usual scalar product. X, now, you should think of belonging as to Cn, and n are those sizes of those blocks. This is the n is the, if you like, the, what is it called? The orbital, the size of the orbital index, and j is the lattice index. So I just form that quadratic form. And if you do that here, and you integrate over the x's, now remember they're complex, and this is a Hermitian product here, scalar product, so this is really an x star, if you like. Now I have to put an I in front of everything because otherwise I have a quadratic form which is indefinite. Now here it mostly oscillates, notice, but I do have this I epsilon, which is very important, and epsilon's positive, so this integral actually makes sense for epsilon positive. I integrate out the x's, and of course I pick up, if I have this observable here, I pick up this guy. It's just Gaussian integration. And I pick up, unfortunately, I pick up this determinant as well. Okay, you cannot avoid that. Okay. Now, to kill this determinant, I should have another integral here in which I have an h, and I have the anti-commuting variables, and I put those up there as well, and then I can get rid of the determinant. But I'm not going to do that right now because I want to do everything in the bosonic setting for the moment. So now... Now, I'm not really interested in the Green's function. I'm interested in the absolute value of the Green's function. So here I've written the absolute value of the Green's function, and I have a determinant to the minus 2, which is unfortunate, but it's there. And so how do I get the absolute value? Well, I have to take this guy with one sign, and I have to multiply him by its complex conjugate. So to do that, I just repeat the operation once again, but one has to be quite careful for mathematical and physical reasons. You notice that I have the I here times I as minus, so I have a minus epsilon. That's a convergent thing. Now, to get the complex conjugate, I need a minus sign in front of here. Otherwise, this is ill-defined integral, okay? So you have to have the signs right. Now, notice I have a minus sign here and a plus sign here. That's as it has to be. And you don't really have much choice about that. And now you can see the hyperbolic symmetry. So we'll look at this in a very special case. So you can understand everything in a very simple case. So let's suppose that H here is a single variable. Now, usually I have this huge matrix, which I've written down. Never mind. Let's suppose it's just a Gaussian random variable belonging to the real with a Gaussian distribution. So it would make things extremely simple. Then, of course, all of this thing looks like x squared, y squared. That's what this becomes. And then I have H. Now you see I have the H is here, and I have the H here, and I combine them together, but notice I have an x squared minus y squared. I have to have that difference. That's the hyperbolic symmetry. And then I think I got my signs here a little bit mixed up, but I have E times x squared minus y squared. Again, from the there's an E, but there's a minus change of sign here. And then I have the epsilon. Now the epsilon breaks the symmetry, of course. Has to break the symmetry, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to define my integrals. Now, if I average over H, all that does is square this. That's all I'm doing. Okay. So this is the baby version of the supersymmetry in the bosonic sector, and you see it's hyperbolic, except for the symmetry breaking term. And notice that the leading term, if I let E equal zero or ignore E, is a quartic term. This is a quartic action. But the hyperbolic symmetry is already there. And the only reason for the hyperbolic symmetry is that I need the absolute value of the Green's function. And so it naturally emerges. Now, when you do this in the fermionic sector with Grassmann variables, you don't have this problem because determinants don't have singularities. Inverse determinants do. And so everything becomes much better behaved, actually. So that is that in a nutshell is the in the bosonic sector is a supersymmetric formalism, and so that's what I sort of my starting point. Okay. Now as I said, I have a quartic action, and now I can explain a little bit what Fyodorov's contribution is, because it's very simple, but it's very nice, in my opinion. He says, well, I have a quartic action, but I'll just make a new matrix for it. I call it P. I don't know what he calls it. I forget now. But I call it P because it's positive in the quadratic form. I just x dot x, x dot y, consider all those possibilities. And these are kind of like polar coordinates that I'm going to be using here. Not quite, but anyhow. And then he introduces Qj, which is P times this matrix. Okay, so that's not definite any longer. And that's where the hyperbolic stuff is going to come in. So if I compute my partition function, which in this case is just going to be the determinant of H minus E with this thing, then all I have to do is to take this guy, put him in here. In other words, P times this matrix, positive matrix, times 1 minus 1, put it in there, write my Jijs, do this. I have a determinant, I have all this thing. And now my integration ranges over all positive matrices. Okay, so that's a rigorous representation for this expression. No approximations made. It's a fairly complicated looking one, but one which we understand reasonably well. It simplifies a lot in the sigma model approximation, which I'll now explain on other transparencies. So that's an exact formula. Let me come to the with that formula. Let me just at least make my statement that we can prove. So we have not handled the full supersymmetric model. We hope to, but we certainly haven't done it yet. So in fact, we have primarily handled the what I call the the bosonic sector, which means that I have these determinants dragging around, which are most unfortunate, but I have them there. And they will only be eliminated after the Grassmann variables are introduced, and I'll show you how to do that, but that comes later. So our main result here says that if you look at this Green's function, we can show that is bounded, so that tells you you have extended states, except this expectation is the wrong expectation. It's in this new weighted expectation in which you have a determinant. It's a measure, but it's a peculiar measure coming from the determinant. So it's not physically very natural, but that's the best we can do. And what our theorem more or less says is that in the sigma model approximation, this Green's function is bounded, which says that in this state we have extended states. It's just the wrong expectation. That's all. So that's the main result. Now let me go to the sigma model approximation. And everything simplifies, as I have on the board there, and you'll see how it comes about. So in the sigma model approximation, here we have the P's. You multiply it here. And now the key statement that just linear algebra says that if I have a positive matrix times such a sigma 3, I can write it, diagonalize it, in terms of a PJ and PJ prime, where these are positive, these are non-negative numbers, eigenvalues, and the TJs are not belonging to SU2, but they belong to SU11. Okay? And all the sigma model approximation says is that the P's, if you check them out, they're fast variables. So these angular variables, which is the TJs, which are these angles here, those are slow variables. So all you do is you find out where the saddle for the P's lies, and you sort of sit there. You have to, in general, of course, you have to integrate these out carefully. And I'll say a word about that some other time. But right now, this is the approximation to think about. The approximation just says PJ is equal to PJ prime, and that's the density of states here at the saddle point, which you compute. And then when you do that, then you get back to this. Basically, we're back to what I have on the board here, because this becomes a multiple of since they're equal, and equal to the density of states, then this becomes 1 minus 1 times some factor of density of states that sits out there. So here we have the rest of it. Now let me show you how this approximation simplifies this rather complicated expression. Well, this will look the same, but let's look at the QJs. Let's look at this term. This is imaginary. It's got an imaginary fluctuation. But notice this matrix has a zero trace. So this will disappear. Okay? Disappears completely because this is a traceless object. Okay? And this determinant, well, this determinant is pretty trivial because, again, I have, it's just one. So this goes away, this goes away. This remains, of course, and I have to do this this part of the integration. That's it. And so when you write this integration, you write this, the dp, you write into this, and of course the integration is a Jacobian, which you have to calculate, which integrates over the SU. You decompose it into basically polar coordinates. These are my radial coordinates, if I like, which I've frozen, and these are my angular coordinates, and that's what I have over here. That's where that comes from. So that is the sigma model approximation. Yes. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, so this is bad notation. See, I have, these are recent, something I made up last night. These P's are capital P's, they're the matrix. These little P's, these are lower, these are just numbers. These are the eigenvalues of the matrix, big P. They are determined, right. But when you do the integration, you have two integrations to do. You have to integration over the slow variables, and you have integration over the fast variables. When you do the integration over the slow variables, the large n tells you that almost all the weight lies where the p, these two guys are equal, and they're equal to, yeah. So you do this, you freeze the angular variables, and then you simply do the saddle point analysis in the eigenvalue part of it, And then you say, well, ultimately, of course, you must do everything. You must integrate over the P's and this. But in this approximation, you simply say, I will ignore the fast variables, and that can't be that important. And when I ignore them, I have to freeze them at some value, which is their saddle. And then the rest is angular stuff, which appears in this board here. Yes. Right. Yeah. So the Goldstone mode is here, of course, and the radial parts should be, at least in this sort of regime, more or less irrelevant. Okay. So now, I've written down the action. I'll just put this back up, but that's pretty much what I have in the blackboard. So I showed you this already. I don't need to do that. So let me make a few other comments about how convexity comes in and so forth. Let's see, what time do I have here? No, I'm running low on time. So let me go to the ideas of the proof. Okay. This is the better one, so I'll put this over here. So this is basically the sigma model I have also written over here. And this epsilon, as I mentioned, is very important. It makes this thing stable, and without it, you can't. You will run into terrible large steel problems. How do we analyze? This looks like a simple guy, except that these are integrating over. I'm integrating over SU2s, and then I have to somehow parameterize this in a way in which I can either use some kind of renormalization group. Or I can do some kind of analysis, because I do not know how to abstractly analyze such an expression. Okay, so I have, it looks like icing, except that we're doing this integral over SU2, so there's something to be done. And here I think there's something. I looked at this for quite a while in another coordinate system, which would be called polar coordinates, but these are horospherical coordinates. And they're extremely well adapted to this problem. I mean, they're like a miracle. So this is a coordinate representation. I've now written them out. The TJs run from, and the SJs are all real numbers. They run from minus infinity to infinity. Now, in the usual polar coordinate representation, this is cosine SI minus SJ. And these are sines and so forth. But in the horospherical coordinates, these guys are Gaussian, just purely Gaussian. And this makes for, you can see this is a fairly non-trivial interaction, but the fact that these are quadratic in the S's certainly is an encouraging fact. And here's the epsilon term, it's also quadratic in the S's. So in principle, we can integrate out the S's. They're quadratic, so we just do the integral. So at first Martin and I tried to see whether this expression was in fact convex. Certainly this is convex, and this term in S is certainly convex. Is the whole thing convex? It is not. It is not. And so that didn't discourage us too much. And so we said to ourselves, well, what we should do is, after all, we have the good fortune of having something Gaussian here, integrate it out. And then you get a new effective action, which is the cosh here, which you began with. And then you have this S integral to do. Well, the S integral gives you a determinant, which we exponentiate, and we have, one half the log of the determinant. And that is what appears in our effective action. So that's a new effective action, A tilde. Okay? So now let me, getting toward the end here, so let me finish the story. Where did they come from? Well, they came from Martin. They came from my collaborator, Martin Zernbauer. They come, to answer your question a little bit better, they come from Iwasawa decomposition. So you break the group up into this normal, it's the nilpotent part that's giving you this quadratic part. So it just comes from group theory, really. But if we did not have this, in other words, then I would not, of course, then I certainly would not know how to do this. But the main result, which I'm about to state here, is that this new action is convex. The old one was not, but the new one is. Okay, and not only is it convex, we can compute its Hessian, we can bound its Hessian from below. So I'll explain that. So we have to do this initial step of integrating these out. Now, in general, I don't think, you know, when I look at the full model, I will never be so lucky as to have this thing quadratic so I can explicitly do the integral. I don't need to explicitly do the integral, but I need to know some qualitative properties if I want to establish convexity. And if they're Gaussian, these things become obvious, actually. So in general, I suppose some renormalization might be necessary at this point. But this is integrating out one of the variables, and it in a way it doesn't seem natural to me, but it works, so I don't worry too much about it. So the statement is here that this AT is convex. It also has a property which is not evident, that if I shift T by a constant, you leave this thing effectively invariant, except for the epsilon. So this is a hyperbolic symmetry, roughly speaking, that's at work here, that I can shift things by T. So you see that's obvious here, if I shift by a constant. It's not obvious what happens over here if I shift by a constant. But then you can absorb that into into the S's, and you'll quickly see that it's invariant under shifts. So it has a gradient structure. Now, if I compute the Hessian here, just this second derivative, then as a quadratic form, just think of it as a function of J and K, as a matrix in JK for fixed T, we can prove that it's always bigger than, this is the discrete Laplacian, this is some new effective beta, or some number which is proportional to N, roughly speaking, and there's the epsilon that comes from this epsilon regularization that also appears here. So that's it. So the fact that we know this guy's still fairly complicated, but this is fairly simple. And once you have this result, you're essentially done, because there's this famous result of Brasskamp and Leib, which really does the job. It takes care of high moments. It takes care of stability. Brasskamp and Leib says, if I have an action, and I know something about the Hessian of that action, namely I know it's positive, and I say I have a bound from below like this, then I can replace, as an upper bound, I can just pretend it's Gaussian, and I have this upper bound, so I'm just computing this as if it were a Gaussian integral, but in fact all I have is this inequality, but that's sufficient to get this bound. Okay. And so that's a very useful inequality, and there have been actually, I think, major extensions of it due to Helfer and Schistrand, which give you much more precise statements. But I don't need them for this talk, so I won't go into those. But they're very useful, I think, for renormalization purposes. So here since you're in three dimensions, you can let epsilon go to zero as the volume goes to infinity, and you have a uniform bound on this on this expression. And the Green's function. So that's roughly speaking the idea that you need to apply convexity. You need the right coordinate system, which happens to be the horospherical coordinates, and you need to do some preliminary work, and namely integrating out the S's. Now, when you have the model, which is a non-sigma model, and you have the eigenvalues fluctuating too, then I have a complex action. And one would think that with complex actions, one would have no chance of applying such an inequality, because, you know, you have oscillations. But what you can in fact do, again, is to integrate out, just imagine integrating out the fast variables. Once you do that, the action becomes real and still convex. This is in the non-sigma model approximation. Okay. This is in the non-sigma model approximation. In the sigma model approximation, the trace vanished. But in general, it doesn't vanish. And so you have to integrate. You have to integrate those fluctuations of the eigenvalues out. The p and the p prime have to be integrated. But when you do it, it's a high temperature expansion. You can check that that all the complexity, you know, the phases, they all disappear, and at least for small energies, and you have a real action again. So you have to do some preliminary work, before you get what you want. But okay, now I think I was just about finished here, but I'd like to show you the full model, and at least in some approximation. If I show you the full model, you might not want to look at it. So this is a kind of sigma model, I would say a kind of sigma model approximation for the full model. It gives you a picture of what's happening. So here's the bosonic guy, which I've been mainly talking about and for which we wrote the horospherical coordinates for. Now the fermionic one looks very similar, except that instead of SU11, we have SU2 here. And that, of course, describes the orbit of it gives you a sphere and gives you the usual classical sigma model. Okay. So what is the total action? Well, a total action is actually not so difficult to write down, and we don't like to have Grassmann variables in at the end. So here in this picture, all the Grassmann variables have been integrated out. Okay. We can actually do all the Grassmann integrations. And this is what we get. We get the action for the bosonic sector, which is just this. The fermionic sector, it's only a little bit of difference here, and this J gets inverted, not point-wise, but as a matrix, it has to be inverted. And you have these guys, which are, this is really a ferromagnetic, when you work it out right. It is really a ferromagnetic Heisenberg model, which we also understand. And then the part that's puzzling us at the moment, and I guess we'll be puzzled for some time, I'm afraid, is this coupling piece. These guys are coupled. And they're coupled through a determinant. And this is the determinant. You take this J, which you can just think of being, as a matrix minus Laplacian plus 1, and you have a potential added to it or subtracted from it. And the potential is a 4x4 matrix. This 4x4 matrix is just the tensor product of these two by two guys. Guys, and that's the fermion-boson coupling. Now, as you can tell, I like to have things which are positive and not fluctuating because it makes analysis much easier. And I will just end with one observation, which is that this guy, this determinant here, is non-negative. It's not totally obvious. It took a little bit of work to see that this guy is actually non-negative. So in this approximation, everything is non-negative. And what we'd like to hope is that after we integrate out these fermions, that we will recover something which is effectively convex in the bosonic sector, and then that would basically complete the argument. So that's where things stand. Thank you very much.